Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
The whole scale of it is just, it's mesmerising. All of those bodies and all of the families.
World of Secrets, Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
There's a very wet chicken poo next to you.
Oh, God, is there?
Welcome to what's become a typical morning in the Van Tulleken house.
I'm sitting next to a little wet pile of digested prawn head.
My wife Diana and I, we're sat in the garden. Our daughters are still asleep upstairs. And we are watching our four increasingly chunky chickens forage in the flower beds. And they're totally mesmerising.
Look at Nugget. I mean, Nugget just relentlessly eats, doesn't he? He's almost 30% bigger than the others.
Yeah.
We've got Nugget, Layla, Foxy and Forks. And I think they're living a pretty good life now. Whenever we're at home, we let them out of their run and they're free range in the garden. The moment they're obsessed with our pond.
But Layla, who's also a Ross 308, is exactly the same size.
A little smaller than Forks, I'd say.
It's all part of an experiment, because I'm meant to be someone who knows about food, but I just don't know enough about where it comes from. So I've got three different breeds of chicken, and I'm figuring out how to raise them, what to feed them, how much space and outside time they get. I want to get to an answer, in my own head at least, about the question of how we ought to be looking after the animals we keep for food, and whether we should keep them for food at all. They're still a couple of weeks off being ready for slaughter, and I've got to admit, my scientific detachment from this project is in tatters. I'm not looking forward to killing them.
Now, Foxy. This is good. Now, Foxy's on Dinah's leg.
Hello, you.
Do you want to hop on my leg?
I'm also going to have to think about how I want to eat these birds, because a traditional roast feels somehow respectful to their memory compared to, I don't know, mincing them up and putting them into nuggets. But, of course, that's how so much of our chicken is consumed. It's fast food. This is Fed, with me, Chris Van Tulleken, exploring why we eat the food we eat. And in this episode, the fast food trap, how did we come to eat so much food that's so bad for us? And why can't we stop? Fast food, junk food, takeaway, whatever you call it, there are a few things that define this kind of food.
They just have the economy of scale. They can mass produce these items in central kitchens and then distribute them very broadly.
This is Emlyn Rood, chicken historian, chicken expert, and weirdly, a chicken hater.
Well, I don't hate it. It's weird that everyone's so obsessed with it.
Including you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the most obsessed, so clearly it's caused problems.
The origins of fast food go back to the 1920s in America, when restaurants like White Castle in Kansas began pioneering an assembly line approach to hawking cheap burgers, inspired in part by Henry Ford's revolutionary motor car factories. McDonald's was founded in the 1940s, Burger King in the 50s, and they sold high-volume, quick-cooked burgers to customers on the go.
It was part of this huge cultural shift in the United States in the 50s of eating out, of car ownership, of going on road trips. And these originally started as hamburger chains.
Beef reigned supreme. At this point, no one was really eating chicken. In fact, it was a real problem. The broiler industry had exploded during the Second World War when the US government pumped money into chicken production as a way of feeding the troops. But post-war, those contracts ended. Demand dwindled. The USA had more chicken than it had ever had, being made cheaper than ever. But no one wanted to eat it.
So one of the issues in the post-World War II period why the chicken industry had such difficulty selling their product was that people found it really boring. You could only go to the grocery store and buy chicken and whole chickens and half chickens. That was it.
No nuggets, no tenders, no popcorn chicken bites. The savior of the industry came from a slightly unexpected place, a Cornell academic food scientist called Robert C. Baker.
He basically invented all of the chicken products that we know and many of us love today. So he's the man who invented the chicken nugget. He invented chicken burger, chicken sausages, many other chicken products that really did not take off.
Baker had grown up on a small family fruit farm during the Depression when food was scarce. He knew hunger firsthand, and he became increasingly obsessed with food waste. From his basement laboratory, he determined to help chicken farmers pull themselves out of the slump. He'd grind up the parts of the bird that no one else was using and make new foods out of them. He invented chicken bacon, chicken hot dogs, canned chicken hash, and a kind of frozen chicken meatloaf.
I had the privilege of going to his archives at Cornell University, which was wild. The man, but he was a true academic. He would just come up with stuff and then put it upon the poor eaters of the surrounding Ithaca area and see if they took to it.
Were there any very notable chicken product failures that you came across in your research?
There's a whole bunch of stuff that I think never flew. One was like a hard-boiled egg ensconced in like gelatinized chicken mush, which is a bit grim. He just tried everything.
I can't decide if Robert C. Baker is the hero or the villain of this story. He revolutionized an industry, changed the way that many of us eat forever, and he single-handedly invented so many products that line our shelves today. But as someone who's written extensively on the dangers of ultra-processed foods, I feel like this well-meaning academic might also be my nemesis. At about the same time as Robert C. Baker was single-handedly inventing a new kind of food, chicken was about to receive a sudden and unexpected endorsement from the US government.
A lot of it has to do with the rise of nutrition science. This is when you get the idea that all of a sudden saturated fat is bad for you.
In the early 1950s, the US government realized that a lot of veterans were coming back and they were dying really young. We're talking about in their 30s or 40s from cardiovascular disease.
They started to really investigate the causes of this, and they discovered that a lot of it had to do with either one of two substances, one being red meat and the other being sugar. There's a lot of debate about why they chose red meat over sugar. Some people argue that the sugar industry just really lobbied to have their product erased from the U.S. government records, but that is a different story from the one we're talking about.
The U.S. government settled on saturated fat in red meat as public health enemy number one.
And so in their first ever nutrition guidelines to the nation, they explicitly said, please stop eating red meat and start eating alternative white meats like chicken.
So the government is putting out this health message, eat chicken, it's good for you. And at exactly the same time, thanks to the work of one slightly obsessed academic, the chicken that's available to buy is starting on this journey toward becoming the ultra-processed product that floods our supermarkets today.
You get a hot dog, you get a hamburger, and now it's not beef, it's the healthy alternative, it's white meat. It's good for you now, even though it's still a hamburger. And it becomes the food that everyone eats basically as their default for every meal.
In 1980, amid plummeting burger sales as the public's warned off beef burgers, McDonald's brings a revolutionary product to market, the Chicken McNugget. The USA eats an estimated 2.3 billion servings of chicken nuggets every year. And to this day, McDonald's claim to have invented it. But their famous McNugget does bear a striking resemblance to a certain breaded, reconstituted chicken-shaped recipe published 17 years previously by who? Robert C. Baker, of course.
Like, he invented what became the chicken nugget. He called it the Chicken Crispy in 1963. And then McDonald's would have the McNugget a decade and a half later. So, I mean, his ideas were just taken by the industry and run with it. He just gave them out for free to the world.
The problem with fast food is that so often its irresistibility is less about the food itself and much more about the things we've done to it, those weird processes and preparations that Robert C. Baker pioneered. It's not the chicken in the chicken nugget that we crave. It's the flavourings and the flavour enhancers in the batter, the salt in the crispy coating, the sugar in the sauces that we dip it in. The food has never been harder to stop eating, and it's never been worse for us either.
We've gotten very good at producing a lot of food at a low price. And this is good. If it wasn't for this revolution in agriculture, people would literally be starving. But there is a trade-off between quantity and quality, and we never measure quality. We don't seem to care about it.
Mark Schatzker is a food journalist and a writer.
What do? I write about food, I eat food, I think about food, I obsess about food, and I research and study food.
Mark's written books on the science of flavour and why certain foods elicit a real craving while others don't. And he has a theory, one that's now backed up by a ton of good science, that one of the reasons we want our nuggets salted, battered and deep fried is because these days the chicken itself is nothing without it.
It's almost difficult to comprehend how chicken has changed since the end of the Second World War in terms of how fast modern chickens grow, the life they lead, and the diet that they consume, and how unbelievably bland they are compared to the chickens that our grandparents and great-grandparents ate.
What chickens would our great-grandparents have been eating? What would they have tasted like? What would they have looked like?
They would have been farmyard chickens, and they peck around the farm during the day. They eat bugs, they eat leaves, they get table scraps. And when chickens consume blades of grass and leaves or bugs, those compounds accumulate in their flesh and gives them flavor. It was an entirely different experience to the chicken we eat today, which is dry, bland, and utterly in need of all the culinary help it can get. And the things we tend to put on the chicken tend to worsen its nutritional quality.
Over the last 100 years, as we've found more efficient ways to grow chickens, raising them quickly, killing them young, and feeding them a cheap monoculture of grains and soy, we've inadvertently stripped the nutrition and, by extension, the flavour out of them too. But then, faced with a bland meat that people no longer wanted to eat, we devised ingenious ways to put it all back in. To put the flavour back in, that is. The flavour, but not the nutrition.
In the 1960s, the flavor industry was born, an industry that previously was just about things like spice extracts and fruit syrups, ballooned into what is now a multi-billion dollar industry in which companies create literally the flavorings that are being lost in the farmyard. We are producing in factories and placing into all sorts of food. Now, often when you buy a chicken, you will see that it has flavoring added. This is a testament to how much flavor has been lost. That flavor has to be added back to chicken. Try and make it taste something like chicken.
What Mark's saying reminds me of a conversation I had right back at the beginning of this series, when I first picked up my day-old chicks from a slightly grotty service station with Steve Wigington. He runs a hatchery and he knows a lot about the modern broiler industry. We were discussing the different available breeds next to his van full of chicks tweeting away, and he told me something that surprised me.
Do you want something that tastes like chicken? Or do you want something that looks like a chicken that may have to be adapted to taste like chicken?
Oh, what do you mean adapted to taste like chicken?
They're either injected with water to give them weight to stop them shriveling up in the oven when you're cooking them, and there may be some products in that solution that enhances the flavour of the chicken.
Like what kind of flavours they put in?
Salt, dextrose, even chicken flavour. but basically like an OXO cube.
I don't even know what to make of that. We're filling our chickens with salt, sugar and chicken flavour.
Yeah. Do people want to know what's actually in the food? On a majority of cases, as long as it's cheap, they're not bothered.
And this is where Mark's theory gets really clever and really interesting. Our addiction to fast food doesn't necessarily come from the flavour itself. It comes from a mismatch in our brain between the flavour and the missing nutrients.
You have to ask the question, why is the brain so obsessed with flavor? Why do we have this chemical sensing device in the middle of our face, which has such an incredible effect on our experience of food? And scientists are increasingly looking at the brain as a prediction engine. Flavor and taste is the brain getting an early read on the nutrients that are coming inside the body. This is how the brain finds nutrients in the world.
When we produce food that lacks flavorful nutrients, and then we artificially replace the flavor with spicy batters or tangy sauces or even stock cube water injected directly into the meat, it means that what should be a reliable relationship between nutrition and flavor in our brains has gone haywire.
There's a more technical word, which is reward prediction error. What it simply means is the brain didn't get what it thought it was going to get. And there's a huge body of literature on this in experimental psychology, and it has a very predictable effect. When the brain experiences uncertainty, it responds with enhanced motivation. It wants more. It has an enhanced state of desire.
Put simply, if you eat something that tastes like chicken, your brain expects something with the nutritional profile of chicken. If those nutrients never come, your brain responds by wanting more and more and more.
So they are, in a very literal sense, imbuing a sensory experience of healthy chicken in chicken that isn't actually that healthy.
While I'm talking to Mark, I'm looking at my own little broiler birds out in the garden pecking around. And I wonder how I'm raising them is going to affect the flavour of their meat. It's at this point in the story that the Vantelican backyard flock experiences a tragedy. And it comes out of nowhere.
Hi, love.
I've left to work early one morning when I get a phone call from home.
My 30 nugget got taken away by a fox.
Oh.
If I hadn't seen the fox, I wouldn't believe it. There is not a sign of a struggle. There is nothing.
Nugget, the Ross 308, the fastest growing and biggest of our birds, the one we suspected was a rooster, is gone.
I went up to get Lyra, saw the fox leaving the outhouse. So I banged on the window, obviously charged back downstairs, straight into the outhouse, and the three were there. So I just thought the chickens are fine. And then I just kept calling for Nugget, looking everywhere for Nugget.
I feel genuinely devastated. The chickens are my responsibility. They were under my care. And I was feeling increasingly bad about the possibility of having to kill and eat Nugget. But having him taken by a predator out of the back garden feels like I've let him down. I failed to protect him. It's a contradictory set of feelings. He died before I could kill him, and that doesn't feel right. And, of course, he died actually a much more natural death for a bird, predation, much more natural than me wringing his neck. But I still feel guilty.
Are you okay, love?
No, I miss Nugget.
Lyra's six, and it's often hard to figure out what she's really feeling, but she's very philosophical about the whole thing.
But it's also a bit good because I didn't even want to eat Nugget because he was being really, 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 really a good chicken, so I didn't want to eat him, but now I don't have to.
Not all the meat in fast food is chicken, of course, but it is one of the biggest players. There is one particular dish that springs immediately to mind.
Fried chicken is amazing. It's one of the best things I think you can eat, which is why I guess we're having this conversation, right? Because it's as problematic as it is delicious. I'm Melissa Thompson. I am a writer and a cook, stroke chef, and I'm a huge advocate for fried chicken.
Melissa grew up in Weymouth, on the Dorset coast.
My dad's Jamaican, so whenever you have family gatherings, you have your fried fish, maybe your patties, like your curry goat, your oxtail, and then your fried chicken, and that's part of the repertoire. And I just loved it. Like, I think it's something that is so much greater than the sum of its parts, right? It's just chicken, spices, flour, and it's, yeah, delicious.
Melissa started out her career cooking fried chicken for a supper club she created in her home, serving it to friends, including me, and family. But it wasn't the southern fried version she made at her supper clubs. It was a Japanese dish, karaage, with chicken marinated in soy sauce, mirin, ginger and garlic, and then deep fried.
I made karaage chicken after my sister-in-law, who's Japanese, showed me how to make it. And I think that was because it kind of tapped into this idea of Japanese food being a bit more kind of refined, and I didn't want to almost associate myself with black chicken because of the racist connotations. While it's celebrated by the black community, it's also been a way to attack the black community, but to attack black people. But people have used it in very racist ways historically.
Tell me a bit about the history of fried chicken. Where does it come from? Who invented it?
The origin of fried chicken has never been deduced exactly, but we think there might have been a Scottish influence from it because there are records describing cooking chicken in fat, but also the kind of the West African influence of a kind of fricassee dish. And obviously, that went over to the Americas, and that version of fried chicken was popularised in the American South, cooked by black chefs. You know, like, black Americans created the food of the American South, but I think it's very telling that the most famous iteration of fried chicken is fronted by a white, mustachioed caricature of a man who claimed to have invented this recipe, never giving credit to the black ingenuity that would have been at the core of this.
Fried chicken is fast food, and it would be easy to write it off as only fast food, as junk. But of course, it's a dish with as much history and heart as any other dish in the world, perhaps more. I want to get a sense of what this dish can be when it's not fast food at all. And Melissa can show me.
So talk me through what you've got here.
So this is chicken thigh.
Melissa's using organic, free-range chicken from her local butcher. She knows it was reared outside and slaughtered at 81 days. So that's already scoring high on the traceability and welfare charts.
It's got more flavour to it, it's got more texture, it's got more bite to it. And then I've marinated it in a Jamaican spice blend.
So I think this is another big difference between you and a chain,
is you're using kind of very traditional flours and foods. Mm-hmm. You're not using a modified cornstarch.
No.
You're just using cornmeal.
Yeah.
It's the industrialization that makes it addictive. It goes from being a thing that you love and that has meaning and has significance into something that everything about the product is engineered to drive addiction.
Yeah, totally. They've industrialized their process. They know exactly what they're doing. They've got people researching how to make this as addictive as possible to ensure people keep coming back. And I can't fight that. When I talk about fried chicken, I don't want it to come across in any way snobbish, because not everyone has the resources to say to cook this type of fried chicken. I don't begrudge anyone who goes to eat fried chicken anywhere. I begrudge the people who make money off those people.
Oh my goodness. Is this, can we just tuck in?
Yeah. It might be quite spicy, but
that is the best fried chicken I've ever had.
Is it good?
That is transcendentally good. That is ridiculous.
If I ever open Chicken Chop, that's going to be the quote. Transcendentally good.
Fast food is irresistible, addictive, habit-forming. We know it's bad for us, but it's a really hard habit to kick. And it's not just the food itself which is the problem. It's a pervasive presence on our high streets through advertising. And for some people, it seeps into every single aspect of their lives. It's inescapable, but it's not the same for everyone. Simply put, if you're surrounded by good food all day long, you'll probably eat it. And if you live surrounded by junk, no matter how good your intentions or how strong your resolve, junk is what you'll eat.
I didn't see it immediately, and nobody sees it immediately because it's just so subtle. It's part of your built environment. Nobody questions it anymore.
Christina is a food justice campaigner.
My name is Christina Adana. I'm a campaigner and co-founder of Capsule Media.
It was her who kicked off the huge national free school meals campaign during lockdown, the one that Marcus Rashford lent his support to back in 2020. Christina was only 16 back then, but it changed government policy for good.
It's like really hard and I have no idea what I'm doing.
That is how all revolutions start, with someone who has no idea what they're doing working really hard. I have enormous faith in you. Christina isn't just a campaigner. She's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Growing up in London, she noticed that the food environment around her home was radically different from the one near her school in Westminster. And it was different from a lot of her schoolmates too.
Yeah, so I lived in South London. My high street looked like chicken shops, takeaways. I used to go to school with my friends and I'd walk over Vauxhall Bridge. And immediately, like once you walk over the bridge, you see a transition in food environments from 99p burgers to a prep just as you get off. It was very, very, very different. And I couldn't afford those options on the other side of the bridge.
It's not just a question of what's for sale on your local high street. It's about how that food is marketed to you and where. It's insidious and, for some people, absolutely relentless. For Christina, it started at school.
Everyone would go to, like, you know, WH Smith or whatever to get their stationery. When you got your receipt, you'd have McDonald's advertisements, like a $1.99 meal. I remember first week of school, we'd like run to McDonald's, see how many tickets we'd have and like buy as many meals as we could. This is the thing that with junk food advertising, the placement is very intentional. The fact that it's the first thing that pops up on my feed, the fact that they pay, you know, our favorite influencers to advertise when we know like these influencers aren't eating crap and we know that our sports stars have the top nutritionists in the world but they're selling us Coca-Cola and Pepsi and McDonald's. And even when we try to eat healthily, advertising strikes again because it's so misleading. You'll have like high in vitamin C, high in B12, high in this, high in fiber on junk food products. It's really, really hard for young people to navigate this broken system.
What strikes me listening to Christina is that we live in the same city, but in entirely different food environments. I live a relatively privileged life. I don't take a lot of public transport, so I'm not exposed to the ads there. I pay subscriptions for my Spotify and my YouTube, so I don't get ads there either. My local neighbourhood has fried chicken shops, yes, but it also has a fancy deli and an organic supermarket. And importantly, I can actually afford to shop there. When you have a bit of money, you can buy your way out of a harmful food environment. When you don't have money, you can't.
They do purposefully target poor people. Sports is such a great example of this. If you go to watch a game of tennis, you're getting sponsors from Rolex and Evian. If you go to watch a football game, they're sponsored by McDonald's and chocolate bars and Coca-Cola. Like, it's so overtly a poverty thing, and they prey on the poor.
I want to bring in like race and culture. Why are certain communities more vulnerable to the fast food industry?
Completely. So what I find interesting is black culture influences everything. And so marketing companies have tried to buy cultural capital. I don't even need to say it. It's like the black man and the fried chicken thing. The way that's been stigmatized and used by marketing to then market back to that audience is just horrifying.
There's a lot of messaging, especially from doctors who work in the media like I do, about healthy food choices, how all we need to do is encourage our patients to make better choices around what they eat. But the more I talk to my patients, the more I've come to believe that these aren't choices at all. And Christina agrees.
We try not to talk about choice and instead talk about the lack of option, because you can't choose between fried chicken and fried chicken, right? You can't choose between burger and burger. Like, it's the same option.
The political side that argues that people need freedom and people should be able to make choices and they have personal responsibility. Do you think personal responsibility has a role to play in the public health debate?
I don't want people to feel like they can do nothing. Because of course, I wake up, I decide what I want to eat and whatever. With food, because it's everywhere and because junk food culture is so normalized, we eventually fall into it. Like, there's no way we can be independent from the exploitative food system that controls all of us.
Next time, chicken goes global. How did a system of farming and trade spread around the world? And who are the winners and the losers?
In reality, agribusiness for us doesn't bring the wealth and development that is so often reported by the big media. It only brings destruction, only misery.
Hi, I'm Simon Jack.
And I'm Zing Sing.
And Good Bad Billionaire is back for a new season, now from the BBC World Service.
Every episode, we pick a billionaire and we find out how they made their money.
And then we judge them. Are they good, bad, or just another billionaire?
So, who are some of the people that you'll hear about in season two?
The richest comedian ever? Jerry Seinfeld's there.
There's also my personal favourite story, the fashion designer who was once a communist mime. That's Miuccia Prada.
And the people behind some of the biggest companies on the planet. Google, TikTok, for example.
But we are kicking off with a sporting superstar, Tiger Woods.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.